By the way, we are recording all the sessions, and we will be recording even more. And we will put everything by edited version on the website, so you can always refer and hear you asking questions and so on. We did this last year, and it was very useful then to transcribe those talks and those thoughts. So we have a lot of material already. So do you have something to say about what we did last time? No?
Oh, I had read this.
Right.
Some people read last week, but then I read...
Oh, introduction.
Yeah. Right. I was just curious about the shift from the Veda to the Vedantic.
Yeah.
I wasn't really clear on what meant.
Okay.
What characterized that shift.
Well, we will come to that. We are just moving to that now, today.
Birds. And it was really interesting, and it felt like it would be nice to look a bit more into understanding what it's about.
Well, yes, it's a symbolic vision. This is the symbolism of the Veda, where things are never spoken in a rational manner. Yes? There's something there which is represented by the symbol of the bird or horse or bull or whatever symbol you take. And because that was an esoteric knowledge, it had to be hidden or packed in some manner. So, but you can always figure out what it means if you read more. Because those symbols you meet everywhere. And then when you collect them together, you see that, how they relate. First of all, this vision of the reality, which was different from rational, was exactly that particular feature that all the manifestation of something, of all this, had many different names or different adjectives, rather. So, first of all, we have to understand how the language worked. It worked in a different way. There were these seed sounds, yes, which could produce any number of words in any direction. You can arrive to this meaning of the table from many different roots, because table does many things, and it can be qualified by many qualifiers. It can be said that it is a wooden thing. It can be said that it has four legs. It can be said that it has a flat surface. It can be said that this flat surface is supporting things put on the top, and so on and so forth. So all these are different roots, and from them you can come to this meaning of the table. Now, that ability to produce meaningful word is a ability of a higher mind, that you will not miss. You will see in all this totality of movements clearly what it means. So it means you are not confused. You are not cut off into the rational structure where you have to always ask what it means and why you call this by that, because you are open to the higher capacity to see. And also you follow the same subjective production of the word. Now, we don't have this capacity anymore. Yeah? We can only kind of guess that that was there. And that's why that language was so luminous and beautiful.
It wasn't really metaphorical when you said a lot of the expression of life.
All is metaphorical.
The whole... of direct movements of nature.
Right. Well, nature itself is metaphorical, yes? All what happens in nature, the sunrise, the sunlight, the dawn, the wind, the storm, are they not metaphors? They are metaphors. So they can be used immediately to express that particular state of consciousness which we experience subjectively. And it is the best cover, and it is the best hiding place for those symbols of consciousness. When I understood this, I was I was shocked, because to hide this knowledge was the best, to pack it into the natural images. The sun is the manifestation of the supramental consciousness. When sun rises fully, we have the manifestation of supramental consciousness. And all is going around it. There is a dawn, the dawn of our illumination. Yes. Then there is the time of Savitar between the dawn and when the disk is visible, the time which is moving light towards its manifestation, from Rutsu to promote, to impel, to push forward the evolution of light. All these were symbols.
So in one way you can say it's symbols to veil, but at the same time they reveal. So it's
yes, they reveal and they hide the revelation, both at the same time.
What I wanted to say, so if you shift in your consciousness, they are not veiling, they're revealing. So it's more shifting this paradigm of this way how consciousness looks at in a way.
Well, the shift was not necessary anymore because we shifted in our paradigms already so far that we lost even the ability to see it, yes? But
the question in a way is the word that was used when it was written was to say ghee, dripping of the butter. Do we understand what we mean now when we use our mind now? A symbol, in a way, is something that's always means that. Maybe we should be able to access it now even. I mean, when you were describing, reading out that section, I was watching the bird dip down and go up. And we straight away, first of all, we see it going down and up. If you turn it that way, it's going in and out. It is respiration.
Right.
The mixing of oil and water.
Right.
Which needs heat.
Wonderful.
It's the body.
Now, but if you meet such passages where, you know, the horses of Indra are dripping with ghee and, you know, with honey and clarified butter, they are dripping everywhere, and the heaven and earth, our father and mother, are full of ghee, ghrita, and full of honey, and they're feeding this baby sitting on their lap, this fire, then you start to think that maybe it's not completely that ghee and not completely honey, physical, there must be something more than that. Now, language had access to this because the roots which are used for gharita, yes, for ghar, ghar from here in a Hindi, hot, that's a hot luminous substance, yellowish or golden, which represents that particular state, or that particular movement within the consciousness. And it becomes clear how it relates through linguistic usage. We can discover those meanings. Yes? Now that ability we lost, we already relating to everything in objective terms. We want to see what it signifies, what kind of thing it is. If it doesn't say consciousness to us, and means there is no consciousness, as if. But all these names are names of consciousness. They are nothing else.
Yes, this is what you mentioned, this is Mohini's, what is behind it, it's the oneness. Huh? That the oneness perceived, or from the oneness to perceive every other thing, see, the outer forms. I mean,
right. It is that oneness, and exactly on that oneness it is based. Without that oneness, this variety is impossible. We cannot really deal with that. Yeah? We would have to cut off into small pieces and define everything as form, sharp form, different from any other form. But if we keep that oneness, then we can see all is meaningfully related. Yes, yes. And if you go even farther to that, you will see how it is used even in later tradition, which we are shifting today to this Vedantic tradition, if we will have time to shift, because I think Vedic consciousness deserves more attention than it looks like. Yes, it looks like that it is something, well, long, archaic, Nobody knows what it is, but without understanding how he started, we cannot continue fully. We would not understand what happened after. What was that real shift? So that's why we dwell or kind of longer than necessary on this particular view. You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I'm wondering if we hadn't preserved something of this form of thinking and direct approach in poetry. Because
sure.
When I hear this, for me it's pure poetry, and I think everybody who is able to understand poetry knows that consciousness must not be mentioned. It's behind what is said.
Exactly.
So I think it's not totally lost in some
form. It's never lost. And that's what it is. This is what even Gebser says, that archaic level in us is most available to us, but we cannot use it because we shift it. Have you noticed such an interesting thing? For example, in Soviet Union we have these communists who were preaching communistic ideas from Tribune and from the university, you know, stage. But when they went home, they were different. They went to church, they put candles for their, you know, okay, nobody sees them. So, how come? Why they couldn't really believe fully and firmly to their own way of rational understanding and scientific, even you take scientists. Now they have to acknowledge that there are different beliefs, belief system, yeah? And they are kind of permitted. You can believe whatever you want, yes? But in a way it is that they cannot reconcile within one frame, within one rational frame of thinking. You cannot see the world. Scientific view is not enough. There is a depth to it. And that depth comes up to here, yes? From here it starts. Somewhere there was a beginning, this luminous beginning. It wasn't a dark beginning. Now, this is another problem, and very difficult to reconcile, even metaphysically. Why Sri Aurobindo was not widely accepted in India? Because of this particular issue. That was the light, full of light beginning, much higher than we think. General conception is that it started from our dark past and developed into what we now are, but it wasn't so, according to Sri Aurobindo. It was rather a fall, a fall from high, luminous beginning towards this rationality and narrowing streams down to the particularities. Those floods of consciousness came down to very particular understandings.
We don't have it in this picture of paradise?
Yes, we have. The same four yugas starting from Satya Yuga and going down to Kali Yuga, to the dark or Iron Age, from golden to Iron Age, from free and spiritual air towards that disaster where the Dharma cow stands on one leg. First she was standing on four, then on three, then on two, then on one. Kali Yuga, you're on one leg, and you're balancing. Because of that, Sri Aurobindo was criticized by his contemporaries, and especially Radhakrishnan. And India did not accept Sri Aurobindo because of that particular view. They said it's very clever to say that Vedic consciousness was so high, and from there we start. But we know that we are progressing, we are not regressing. But they didn't see that it was a
cycle.
Yes, it was a cycle. We had to start from luminous beginning, come down, as Sri Aurobindo says, to the very narrow consciousness, and then again break through to even wider floods. And again, it's like, it's this motion in evolution which is necessary to work out the manifestation of the divine. Yes, I will not dwell on these texts. Please, you look for yourself. On the website, all these texts are there. They are wonderful texts. I selected the best of them. Especially Atharva Veda also is wonderful. And Vachaspati. I'm sure there is much to learn, and it's only the beginning. Since it is an introduction, so we will do it this way. Now we are moving to the section which is called the Vedic concept of the word in the light of Sri Aurobindo. And Sri Aurobindo wrote a lot in it. Most wonderful text. Maybe I have to make a selection and put it on the website that you can immediately, directly download them and read for yourself. Actually, if Sri Aurobindo would not be there, I am not sure we would have any understanding of that particular period. There is nobody else coming so close and so clear to this knowledge. So I will read few quotations here to charge us with that meaning. Is it visible for you?
Yes.
So in the system of mystics, writes Sri Aurobindo, which has partially survived in the schools of Indian yoga, the word is a power. The word creates. Now it's not only in the system of Vedic knowledge, it's also in the system of Greek, as we know, yes? Logos and Hebrew. So, for all creation is expression. Everything exists already in the secret abode of the infinite. Guhahita, hidden in the cave, and has only to be brought out here in apparent form by the active consciousness. That's what is happening to us. We are bringing something which is inherent within us by our active consciousness. We are actualizing it in the word. We are actualizing it in the word to become aware of it in our consciousness, in our outer consciousness. In this way we bring it to manifestation. All the concepts, all the meanings are coming through this way. And they are embodied here in this what we see as manifestation. It's a simple vision, but it is true. Certain schools of Vedic thought even suppose the worlds to have been created by the goddess word, Vaj. And we will come to this concept later in a Tantra. And sound as first etheric vibration to have preceded formation. In the Veda itself, there are passages which treat the poetic measures of the sacred mantras Anushtup, Trishtup, Jagati, Gayatri as symbolic of the rhythms in which the universal movement of things is cast. You remember those of you who come to poetry class? We look into those rhythms. They are differently treated in Vedic tradition. It is understood that these rhythms are living power pulsations which call for the word, and the word has to fill them in. And they will manifest the meaning. There was a very interesting exercise I did in my life. When you read poetry, some of you read, some of powerful poets, like maybe Shakespeare, or if you read aloud, or even not aloud, but for yourself, then you go to sleep, and you can't sleep. Some of you may have had this experience. You can't sleep because there is something there pulsating and demands words. Demands. The words are kind of trying to fill it in and they can't. And then you have to reselect and, oh God, what is this? And again the words come and they try and they do not fit again into that rhythm and rhythm again. And this is what these rhythms are. They are filled with words. And they manifest something. They are the power of consciousness. And there are different powers. Now we could look into them closer, of course, if we would have time. Maybe in different course, not this one. They are very powerful, all of them. I can read to you a few of them just for you to hear how they sound, what they do to your, what kind of rhythm they have. Maybe I should, since we came to Anushtup, Trishtup, Jagati and Gayatri, you will be surprised how different and how simple they are. Now if I take some of them, they are all mainly iambic rhythm. Ta-ta, 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 ta-ta. Ta-ta. The iambic foot is, first is weak, second is strong. And it is so that the pada, which consists of 8 feet, is constituting Anushtup and Gayatri. Yes? We have Agni Mile Purohitam Yajnasya Devam Ritvijam Hotaram Ratnadhatamam. This is Gayatri, yes? Tatsavitur Vareniyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Dhiyo Yonav Prachodayat. Three padas with 8 syllables, 4 feet each, 4 iambic feet. Anushtup has the same, only 4 padas, yes? Dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yuyutsava mamaka pandavaschaye kimakurvata sanjaya. One more, and there will be the whole epic written, the whole Ramayana, the whole Mahabharata written in Anushtup. 8, 8, 8, 8. Very powerful rhythm. It flows. It is not ending. Gayatri is more sharp. It ends. Yeah? Now, we have 2 more very powerful rhythms, and it is Trishtup, which has already cadenza and caesura, which has opening and closing. It's already 11 syllabic rhythm. And Jagati, 12 syllabic rhythm. A little bigger and very beautiful. I will read to you a few of them. From book 5, of course, which I know because I studied it. I would not dare to read to you something I do not know, because it is tricky. You have to deconstruct it. Okay, now one of the most powerful beginnings of the book 5. Abodhi Agnih. This is iambic opening and trochaic closing. Abodhi Agnih Samidha Jananam Pratidhenum Ivayati Mushasam Yahvaiva Pravayamujjihanah Prabhanavah Sisrate Nakam Accha. Abodhi Hota Yajathaya Devan Urdhvo Agnih Sumanav Pratarasthat Samidhasya Rushadadarshi Pajo Mahandevas Tamaso Niramochi. 11 iambic opening, trochaic closing. Jagati is another 12.
Can you remind the trochaic structure?
Is ta 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 ta. First is strong, second is weak. Opposite to iambic. Iambic first is weak, second is strong. Just for you to know. And of course, Jagati is another rhythm which flows differently, and just for you to have a taste of it. And I will go ahead.
So the rhythms, they are counted through the syllables, independently if they are short or long.
Yeah, we have much more problems in the Sanskrit literature than in English poetry, because English does not have long and short syllables differently accented. Once it is accented, it will be long. Once it is unaccented, it will be short. Very rarely it will be long, but in Sanskrit everything is possible. You can have accent on short, where 2 longs are there unaccented, so you have a completely different possibilities.
But in
They mean this are counted on the numbers of syllables.
Yes, only numbers of syllables. And they have to be reconstructed in that way. Tuvam agnarthaya vah samidhire. This is Jagati, 12. Pratnam pratnasa utaye sahaskrita. Purushchandram yajatam vishvadhayasam damuna samgrihapatim vareniyam. It's different. Now, Sanskrit fits into this rhythm very well. So, Sanskrit language has to feel this demand. Yeah? Just for you to have a taste. I will not dwell on it. If you want to know more of it, I would be very happy to show you how it works with all and why this Vedic accent comes into being, because this was the only way to preserve the text. Yes, the easiest, the most precise and concise way to fix it. You cannot fix reading of the text, because if you read it in a proper way, the text will be lost in no time. In 10 years will be nothing left. Yeah, everybody will do something else. But if you fix it in this particular way, you will preserve the accentuation in every word, and the whole structure, and the whole poetic rhythm, everything. So it was a very clever system. Yes?
But you're not saying that that is the only motivation for the rhythm.
No,
that's the byproduct of that.
I'm saying that Vedic accent was a necessity to preserve the text over millennia, and that's it.
Okay, and so basically that the rhythm is there because it's an oral...
They lost the rhythm and they lost the meaning because of that particular preservation, but they preserved the text.
It has to be reconstructed.
So that...
That has to be reconstructed. Or deconstruct it if you want to read it meaningfully as a poem. Can we imagine Rishis were reading in this way? Agnimihile purohitam yajnasya devam rutvijam. Who would read poetry like this? This is a construct which helps to preserve text. Whoever will be there to pronounce it will fix right that text over millennia. So how could you give so much text, 10,000 verses of this book? The one person has to learn this book by heart. And without any deviation from the accent, nowhere, in no one word, to give it to the next person to come. And next, without any change. How would that be possible if that would be not that system which is fixing the exact accent? And then you have to sacrifice the meaning. Now, you can't have these meaningful hymns in meaningful manner read, because if you read them with the meaning, you will burst into something. Two of them, three of them are more than enough. You are full of meaning. Now, how would you really read this over millennia, one text after the text after the text, if you would understand the meaning? It would not be possible. Did you try to read in a meaningful way Savitri, for example? How long can you endure that light? So you will have to read it in a meaningless way, yes? So you have to formally read it, otherwise you would not be able to transmit the text. So it was fixed very, very beautifully, and it was applied, of course, ritualistically. Otherwise, if I read to you with full meaning and attention to the meaning of the word, we read three shlokas, and we were full of it. Now, if you are to read the whole book, 10,000 of them, in 1 week, in that way, I don't know, maybe you will reach the highest.
The rhythm has encoded the meaning, but it's not the meaning itself. The rhythm is just the carrier.
Yes.
And we have to reopen it.
Yes. we don't have the rhythm anymore. By the way, this rhythm which is left, Agni Mihile, is not rhythm. It's another system where the rhythm of chandas is lost. You don't have it anymore. Because of these particular ways, if you want, we can look into that in detail for those who want. Why and how it was lost and where we don't see it anymore. Because Svarita started to become higher, it became doubled, all the Svarita short syllables became long syllables, and so on. There are so many distortions. But there, you can reconstruct the text on because we know about these distortions. This is a distorted text for the sake of transmission, distorted purposely.
So we are lucky because somebody asked, which we are reading is there, and
we came to. The text had to be. I'm speaking in a language you would never hear anywhere in the world. Anybody saying this, what I said, because nobody dares even to think that the Vedic accent itself is sacred, you know, for India. Nobody would even think that there is another way of reading. But there is another way of reading, mantric way, which rishis were speaking. They were speaking, they were not singing.
Maybe you can also mention that on these different rhythms, if you chant them in the traditional way, none of them rhythm is distinguished. It all sounds always the same.
Yes, if I read to you all these rhythms, Anushtup, Trishtup, Gayatri, you would not hear the difference. Because Agni Mihile Purohitam Yajnasya Devam Ritvijam Hotaram Ratnadhatamam. And I can join Trishtub, Anushtub, Jagati, and it will go on and on and on, because the rhythm of the word as a phrase, yes, as a food, as a pada, is not there anymore. It's not important, because the text has to be preserved by accent, by morphological accent.
I think it's important to discern, because you said they were not speaking or they were not singing. You said they were speaking but not singing the text. Now there's basically the, as it is preserved, it is recited. So recitation is between speech and song.
The thing is that, if you take Pratishakyas, the texts which prescribe how to read the text, you will find two ways. One is what is called Vedic accent, and Vedic accent is to preserve exactly in every word morphological accent. Now, can you imagine that? That throughout the Veda, throughout this book, every word bears the same accent, never alters. It's not surprising, yes? But if you were into linguistic studies, you would be shocked to hear this. It's never altered. Now, if you have agnih, and stress falls on the second syllable, agnih, not agnih as we say it now, agnih, and rishih, yeah, and kavih, then throughout the text, agnih will be agnih, and not agnih. There will be no alteration of accent, because that was preserved by this particular accent. It was fixed in the text in a proper manner. Now, that fixation is very valuable to us because we have authentic text, yes, which was from the beginning of time. We can trust it. It's not something which got distorted or composed later. It's an original text. Now, generations of Brahmins, I don't know how many of them, were doing this work, studying this by heart. This was prohibited to write. You know, Aitareya Brahmana prohibits to write this text. The earliest written copy is 11th century AD. Because in India you don't have anything written on palm leaves, it disappears. It was prohibited to write this text. You can receive it only from your teacher, only through oral tradition. Teacher is responsible what he gives to you and to whom he gives his knowledge. Finish. Now, when, of course, You can't destroy such civilization where people carry these texts within their memory. You can burn Alexandria, but you can't burn the whole India and everybody else, everybody existing. There will be somebody there in the corner who will remember the text and he will start, you know, transmitting it as he got it.
Yeah, the same thing in
the
system. The same thing is only by my master, not arrived in the modern house of the earth. It's the same. And we have this situation in Afghanistan when they stopped the music life there. They tried to burn everything and bring it down. But the music is running, still running, and now it's coming alive again in the same line. There's no break.
This is the beauty of this tradition, yes? And we have to pay tribute to it because of that. Of course, they lost something, well, they had to lose. Most probably there was not yet time for that, to really recover that meaning. So we are now at the beginning of this recovery. I hope. It's such a thing to say.
Then could you give an example, for instance, on a verse, the different layers you have in a Vedic verse? You have the accent, the intonation,
you want to go
the rhythm, you have the meaning.
Really?
What else would be there? Just, I mean, to see how language was used in the layers of it. Because nowadays we use language possibly in two layers. There's an information, I'm asking you something, and maybe there's a certain intonation or feel behind it. But that's about it, what we understand of language.
Do you really want to see this particular, how all these things, the complexity of the poetry, that may help for the poetic class to see less complexity in a... I thought to do this, but then I thought it would be too much. I knew that you would be interested. We could always meet and look into that. Okay, then I will write, if you don't mind, yeah?
Just an example.
Yes, one example. And then, suppose I take one rhythm, which one hymn, yeah? Which will be the easiest one, the first one, most probably will be the easiest, because it's not long. If I take few Agneem, now I want to put accent here. So how accent was preserved? Now accent would be like this. I will put you everywhere morphological accent. You know what is morphological accent, yes? Every word has one accent.
It means a tonic accent?
No, it's a... If I would change accent in English language, you would not understand a word in my flow of speech. Did you try this to do for fun?
Yes.
It's very difficult to do, but if you really can do, you have to write it and distort it accents, yeah? And then you would understand nothing. Sometimes French people speak to you in that way, but you have to you have to reconnect, reconsider. Yeah, because of the accentuation which falls on the last syllable. But what I want to say, it's a very interesting thing. There are words which bear several accents, yes? But they are composed like satisfaction. Satisfaction. So in a way you will see that these people who are working in the TV, you know, who are presenting news, or they are trained to exaggerate accentuation. Why? Because even if you don't hear clearly what they said, you will hear that particular shift by which you will reconstruct later. You can hear that through the noise, through the distortion, because of the satisfaction. Now, if you look into these exaggerations, you will see that satisfaction. What is happening here? In order to make an accent in the word, you have to go down. Yeah? So they go deep down. Satisfaction. So to make faction, in order to play on the piano forte, how do you play forte? You don't play forte just pressing more. You play by piano before. So the previous syllable has to be piano for this to be forte. Otherwise, how would you make everything forte if everything is already forte on one level? So if one level is maintained, you have to... So that is satus, faction. So you go down in order for that syllable to stick out. This sticking out is morphological accent in the word. Yes? Every word is accentuated in particular way. In this way we recognize them in the flow of speech. Otherwise, in this flow, syllable after syllable, we would not hear these entities as words.
Is that what makes the difference between desert and dessert?
Yes, desert and dessert. So, in a way, I will put your morphological accent, agnim. Now, this will be ile, will be not accentuated, because the verb which is within or at the end is not accentuated. There are interesting rules. You will find interesting things. Purohitam. Agnim ile, purohitam. Yajnasya, devam, rit, vijam. Now, this is the accent of the word. How would you preserve such poetry if you have to read and remember this? If this is already iambic rhythm. Iambic rhythm, agnim, it fits here, agnim. Ile, okay, here may appear accent because of iambic rhythm. Puro fits, hitam, yajnyas fits. Yajnyasya, de, bom. Doesn't fit. Ritvi jam doesn't fit. Last two words do not fit. So you, how would you, if I read in iambic rhythm, I would lose this accent of both of these words. In time, very soon, in no time. But then if I read it as a proper accent, I will lose the rhythm. Agni mile purohitam yajnasya devam ritvijam. Oops. So there is something has to be compromised. And I am not speaking about long and short syllables yet. It's complicating even more the issue. Now to preserve this and to have it for the future, you will have to find a way. So the way was found. The way is very simple. In order for this syllable to be high-pitched, you have to put this into the low pitch. Yeah? As we did Sajus, Faction. Agnim. So Agnim, Agnim. So the three syllables are like this. Yes? There's one tone here. The low syllable is tone lower than the middle, than the high pitch. And there is one higher, which is falling pitch, which I will explain. Now, you see, if I say satisfaction, it's simply I cannot say kshan in a way that it will be down. It will be a falling pitch. Satisfaction. You will hear this. If you record, you will even see it falling. It's a very interesting thing. Once you are high with your vocal cords, you cannot go immediately down. It falls slowly. When you relax them, it takes time to fall because the tension in the vocal cords is still there. Now this is called falling pitch after post-accent, so to say. So this post-accent has to fall on the next if it is free. Free means if it is not again morphological accent. Yeah? Because morphological is strong accent, it will take on itself. This one is free, so it will take what we call svarita. Svarita is a falling pitch, post-accent. So that's it. That's all device. There is nothing more to it. This is all Vedic accentuation. Very clear. So you have agnim ile, puro itam, this has to be read in this way as Rig Pratishakya prescribes. Agni Mile Purohitam, falling pitch. On the same, from the same level. Agni Mile Purohitam. Because Rig Pratishakya could not sustain its reading, there was Taittiriya Pratishakya came in with Taittiriya Samhita, which prescribed that this falling pitch has to be even higher than Udatta to hear the change. It had to be distorted to fix it. Makes sense. Distortion was necessary to fix the falling pitch, not to be ever mistaken that the falling pitch is there. So what happened? Agni Mile. Instead of falling, it is like Agni Mile. So it goes like this and then goes up and goes down. Because it's a long syllable. Agni Mile Purohitam. Purohitam. Now, he is a short syllable, but it became long because of Svarita. Now, if Svarita is higher than Udatta, to really accentuate it, to hold it, you make two matras, and you will hear everywhere Brahmins in India read, for all short Svaritas, two matras. That means long syllable. Purohitam, not Purohitam. You will not hear Purohitam anywhere in reading, only Purohitam, because it's fixed. It's fixed from teacher to the student. He doesn't think. He got it like this. Yajnasya. What happened here? Yajna. It's just to be falling, but it is Svarita. Yajnasya. Devam. This is Rutvijam. These two are marking this one, are necessary only to hold this over millennia, nothing else.
So,
this is the device.
With Devam, there's no falling to it. So, how is that maintained?
Oh, this is a very good question. No shock from my end. Why this is not Svarita here? It should be Svarita, this falling, because here is Udatta. Is morphological accent. Now, in order for morphological accent to be emphasized, you have to put this pitch down. So there is a preference between holding here up to mark that previous one or mark next one. So we have what we call in Sanskrit progressive or regressive assimilation. Yes? So basically, what is happening, the preference falls for Udatta. Yes, for Udatta to come and not for Udatta which is already gone. This is the preference. It's the preference in our vocal cords. Now, if I am to emphasize next forte, I will make piano. It's a special effort to make it, but I will make it. It's not easy to jump from high down, but I will make it because next is again, yeah? Do you understand the preference? The preference is not to go for the previous one, which was high pitch, but to go for the next, which is high to come. It's a fixed preference, yes? It's throughout the text, the same. But the same structure. Yajnasya Ritvijam Ritvijam. This is Taittiriya reading.
So could you give us a reading of the first two lines with the accent and then with the rhythm, because if the Gayatri is there,
yeah.
Is there a difference in the rhythm?
Yes.
If you emphasize the rhythm or if you emphasize
we are so much in love with this Vedic accent, you can't imagine. We are all melting and we would like to hear this all the time. Can you imagine, it's for millennia, I don't know how many, 6,000 years people are chanting in this way. Of course, it's already fully. Nobody would give up this particular, it's like a drug of some kind. We became drug addicted to this beautiful melody. And I myself, many times, kind of falling into that trap. But I know that this is not the way poetry was read. I know it. This is the device. And I can see the development in Pratishakyas. Rig Pratishakya prescribes Agnini, Purohit, Yajnasya, Devam, Rutvijam. Now we are reading all in Taittiriya style, that Svarita is higher than Udatta. Agnini le purohitam yajnasya devam rutvijam hotaram ratnadhatam. You feel the fullness of the sound, and you don't need explanations. Please don't tell me what you think. Don't come with your rationalities and symbolisms. I am already there. But we are one foot there. We are not fully there. This is the problem. So it stays as if it is, it's like a magic of some kind, like a spell on you. You can't get out of it. Because you don't need to know the meaning. But if you know the meaning, you wake up completely different. You want to know the meaning?
Yes.
The first, it is the first verse of the Veda. Agni nile purohitam. I adore ile. Or I seek with adoration Agni. Who is put in front, purohitam, established in front of my journey. Yajnasya devam, the god of the sacrifice. Ritvijam, the one who knows how to make this offering in time. In every portion of time he knows what to do and how to do it. Hotaram, the one who summoners, Sri Witnesses, yes? Who invokes the presence of the gods, who brings the gods through himself to manifestation. Ratnadhataman, most bestowing upon us the riches. So if we dwell on these meanings and we know who Agni is the Lord growing within manifestation, within our being, these are all his characteristics. He is put in front of our journey. He is the Lord of this sacrifice. What does it mean, the Lord of the sacrifice? Means that he sacrifices, he a god, as Rig Veda says. Gods. Abodhi hota yajathaya devan, and evoke the fire. The fire evoke to sacrifice here the gods. He brings the godly, God's powers down to this manifestation. He is the god of the sacrifice, the shining being who brings all shining powers into this manifestation, immortal among mortals. And he knows how to do it. And he knows how to invoke those powers, how to offer them. And he knows how to bestow upon us the greatest riches. This is all I'm doing. Now I put this just to show you Namo Bharanta Emasi. These are completely against iambic rhythm. Namo Bharanta Emasi. Which cannot be maintained unless we have this device which will regulate the whole structure of the text and preserve every word separately in accurate accentuation. Now, in order to preserve this text, it wasn't enough to go this way. There were many ways of reciting it, as you know, yes? There were 8 different types of recitation. And these types are marvelous, yes? If you hear them, Agni mire, for example, Agni mire, Iye Agni, Agni mire, Purohitam, Purohitam, Iye Agni, and so on and so forth. They were jonglering with this, all these words in all different ways. There was way, Agni, Ratnadhatam, Agni mire, Ratnadhatam, Agni mihile purohitam ratnam ways, upside down, inside out, and there are all these described. If you want to know the file, I can download your file, and you can see the ways of reciting, because then you fix the text for sure. There can't be mistake. Yeah? You have to compare them in your mind and hear them. So all these ways of reciting are here given in this book at the end. Anyhow, that's how text was preserved and how it was distorted. How the poetry disappeared, but something got fixed. Huh?
How would you read the original? The chanda, you would emphasize on the chanda.
Yes. Agnim ile purohitam yajnasya devam ritvijam hotaram ratnadhatamam. Agniv purve bhirshibhiridiyonutanairutasa devaneha vakshati agnirhota kavikratuv satyashchitra shravastama devo deve bhiragamat. This is the poetry.
So the poetry is one tone, there is no music anymore.
Yes. Yeah, by the way, it's very good that he mentioned Ekashruti. Ekashruti is another way, legal way to recite this text, which is prescribed by Pratishakyas. Pratishakyas are saying that you can read in this way to preserve the accentuation, or you can read in Ekashruti, that Ekashruti is unchanging tone, where chandas may appear. But then you have to reconstruct text, because text got changed by this tradition. For example, the easiest example is Tat Savitur Varenyam, seven syllables instead of eight, but Varenyam. Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi. That has to be reconstructed. There is a very nice reconstruction done by Harvard University, by the way, and it's on the website. You can see they did the whole Rig Veda. They put a scientific reconstruction of the text to fit to chandas. It's one of the most reliable. You can see. I download it always.
So this rhythm, this way of reciting, is there to preserve. So if you take it away, you allow the individual to pronounce the poetry. One person may exaggerate one word.
Exactly.
Another word.
Exactly.
So you would suggest that we take the freedom.
Yeah, I say that we now have the text with us. The work is done. This great work, this unbelievable preservation of the text of such kind, is successfully completed. Now we have text with us, authentic text. We can read it. We can read it as poetry. And I even think, I will tell you even more what I think, that if India does that, India will recover its knowledge. Its knowledge, yes. India's knowledge can be recovered through recovery of reading. Because this reading is putting you into hypnotizing you. It doesn't give you any chance to think what it means. It's already fixed by millennia.
Maybe one could also mention one thing. Of course, the distortion is always there, but for example, what happened to myself, for years I was analyzing these texts, and I didn't follow this traditional chanting. I wanted to chant according to meaning. And so I was always translating from inner meaning and emphasizing the meaning, which is in a way a distortion. But even then, it left me many times spontaneously to get into this yamic rhythm, which even I didn't know.
Yes, it was
there. It's underlying. It's there because it is poetry. So even if you don't care for the thing you chant it, it might, you know, the poetry is trying itself. The rhythm wants to come out also. It's under because it's underlying these words. So this is also a fact. So it even tries to re-establish itself in some way if one is receptive.
So it's only enough to read actually in Ekashruti with the right accent, morphological accent.
I will tell you even different. You don't need to read in Ekashruti. You read it with your voice, with your soul.
Yes.
You don't need to make this kind of, you don't have to go to this ritualistic way of seeing things, that you have to be precise with every word. You know, they were threatening this with this precision only because the text had to be preserved. That was a major point. But now, once text is preserved, this, it's a superstition. You have to read it with meaning, with your heart, with your soul, with your mind. You have to make distortions of your own in order to really make the text of your own. You can't really follow the same prescription.
You want to say the time has come when we are supposed to understand.
To use this text, yes.
Yeah. So we don't need to preserve it in this way anymore.
Because it is preserved.
Yes.
Just time has come, we have to understand.
Exactly.
So actually the message came from the own world to us now. So we are lucky.
Yes. Yes, we are very lucky.
I have a question. What happened then, we still talk about language, when Samrig hymns were taken and put into Saman? And the, was that, because there really you talk about distortions with added syllables and
now, some
what
of
was
it
that step in, how does it, not technically, I'm asking, but symbolically, what is that step for you from the poetic text then into a recitative text, and then into Samadhi, into singing text? What does it mean? What is the involvement of those stages?
You know Samaveda, yes, and Yajurveda. There are a little bit different ways of recitation of these texts. Samaveda is very different, yes? It is indulging in all those sounds and all those syllables. It holds them long, yes? You have before the word is coming, you know, you do not know what it is, and then finally it comes. I think this was a very interesting way of, well, Sri Krishna himself says among Vedas he is Samaveda. It means something. Samaveda belongs to heaven. Rigveda belongs to earth. Yajurveda belongs to space between heaven and earth. Samaveda was, as I was thinking, and there is some intuition about this, somewhere Mother in the Agenda speaks about this, that the word which sounds here is not the same way sounding there in heaven. It has another dimension, another stretching time. Most probably they knew something about it, and they tried to bring it down in the specific form. The embodiment of the word which, as it is heard in heaven, that's why it becomes this singing, prolonged. You know, you dwell on it, on this sound. You go deep into the sound. Mm-hmm. Sound becomes the carrier of all your being, not even meaning anymore. So that can be a possible answer.
Can you also mention this? You said Samaveda to the heaven, and then the Vedic to the middle?
Yes, Rigveda is of the earth, belonging to the earth, and Yajurveda to space between heaven and earth.
Maybe it's also interesting, I don't know, here to mention what Sri Aurobindo explains about them, that what is the Rig and what is the Yajur and the Sam.
Yes. Yes. You shall say.
You know it,
no, you say it.
In the essays of the Gita, Sri Aurobindo, when Sri Krishna says, I am the Sri Vedas, Sri Aurobindo explains the Rig Veda is the word that lights up the mind, and the Yajurveda is the word for the right ordaining of action. And the Samaveda is to bring this equal harmony of the divine delight into the being. So we are listening to the Ananda.
Interesting.
Yeah, these are very interesting ritualistic visions also. You can find these identifications very differently spoken of. You can find that Rigveda always belongs to earth, yes? But Samaveda and Yajurveda is not really clear. Yajurveda sometimes is identified with heaven, in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for example. And Samaveda with Antariksha. which is uniting heaven and earth. But in a higher sense, that which is coming from before heaven and earth, which embraces them both. So it is supreme to, how to say, it is transcendental to heaven and earth. It's not only uniting them, it's also transcendental to them. So that's why Samaveda is of that delight, which belongs to this bhakti, yes? Khanda of the Gita. In the Gita he's mentioning about this. Yajurveda is already realization or the action. This is the action of the formula, igniting the mind, rik, because it's belonging to earth. It will ignite the mind. Mind will give you the proper action back, like heaven and earth, and Saman will give you that union of delight of these two. Well, these are other ways of talking about it, which is of later time. So, all right, for today we stop here. Unfortunately, we didn't move anywhere because of this. Yes, but it might help you with Rod's class on poetry to see these complications in the light of English poetry. Also with accent, what accent means. And that's why you have in French very interesting melody of language, because every time when the udatta or the morphological accent falls on the last syllable in every word, it ignites in the next word the svarita. And I always listened to French and I was surprised, is it really on the last or on the first? Because the first still carries a little bit. If you observe how you speak, it will make this beautiful melody. The last accentuated syllable and the first is still carrying the echo of that. And that echo is very essential for the melody of speech. That creates the melody of the flow. All right, so we will stop today and
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.